accession number 18045, Reel 2.
Three ounces of plastic with your primer in the centre, your safety fuse, and a time pencil on the end so that you could put them onto a target and clear the area, and then the bomb would go off at whatever the time pencil you were using. And we started off by using half-hour time pencils, but that was altered later on through experience of things going up while you're still on the airfield, and they were changed to 2 hours.
How do you attach them to the type of planes?
On a fighter, you could put them on the Messerschmitt, on the 9Fs, you could just pull the window back, whatever they call it, you know, put it in a cockpit, or stick it on the wings, but it was best to put them in the cockpit,
right.
on the Messerschmitt. On the bomber planes, you know, on the planes they were using, the bomb Malta, the big Savoyas and things, you had to throw them up, and I mean the wings were about 12, 14 feet high, and these were in a little canvas bag, and just sticking out was the safety fuse with the time pencil on. So you pulled your pin out, bit the acid tube at the end of the time pencil, which started the acid motion, and just lobbed the ration bag on top of the wing of the plane. And Paddy and myself did 15 of these at Benghazi. We just threw the things up on top of the wings. Chucks, you just put them on a petrol tank, you know, and whatever thing you were after.
What sort of uniforms did you have? Was it just very standard?
You just had KD, you know, the khaki drill. That's all you had. Which was an asset because they all wore KD. You see, the Germans wore it. This was the beauty of KD. You could be behind the lines. You didn't look any different to a German, really.
That was standard kit on both sides, was it, KD? Was it?
Yes, yeah. Khaki drill. We were all issued right from the beginning with the Italian rucksacks, which SAS still use, and they've used them right the way through, you know.
Why Italian rucksacks?
Well, they're the ones we got hold of. God knows where they got them from, but they got... I don't know where they got them from, but knowing David Stirling, he got them. And of course, they were wonderful things. And so you had your belt on with your compass, your pistol, all that stuff around your belt, you know. And your rucksack would be packed with all sorts, you know, with rations, water, etc. Then when you went and did a job, you just had what we call our escape kit. You had your belt and you had a small haversack slung with Lewis bombs in. So you had water for the march, your compass, your weapon, your pistol, ammunition, and you were very light. You know, it was so easy to go into march and say how far you had to march and get rid of your bombs.
When were you aware they were calling themselves L Detachment SAS, but when did that come about?
From the day. From the first day it started.
What about the emblem?
And I think the that was a bluff for the enemy, the first SAS regiment part of it. You know, it was L Detachment First Special Air Service Brigade, if I remember rightly. I think you'll have to check on that. First Special Air Service Regiment.
Right.
And of course, it wasn't a regiment, it was only 50, 56 strong. But that was a bluff to the enemy, you know.
What about the badge? When did that come about?
The cap badge. David Stirling put it round to all the members of the regiment to devise a badge for the old detachment SAS. And the one that it is out now was that was done by a chap named Bob Tate, who came from 11 Commando, who's now dead. And Bob designed the wing dagger, although at that time I'm sure he didn't call it a wing dagger, he called it a winged the flaming sword. But it became the wing dagger over the years, and Colonel David put the motto, "Who dares wins." And the wings of it, the brass wings, you know, that were awarded to the people that had earned them, or that they were worn on back to the arm by other people, they were the wings of Egypt. If you have a look at the wings of Egypt, you'll see that they are taken from that. I think David Stirling and Jock Lewis took that one up, you know, the wings.
When you went out on operations, I mean, did you wear, well, going on, what kind of, you were wearing what kind of berets at the time? I know you were talking about white berets.
Oh, well, we didn't wear, we took stocking caps on ops.
But, sorry, on general.
Oh, general, no, yeah. What were we wearing? In the commandos. Good God, I can't really remember.
I mean,
what was devised was, after the first operation, I can't remember honestly what we wore before that. But what was devised, when we came back from the first operation and we were presented with the breast wings, and given about 3 months' pay to go to Cairo on leave, and we're also presented with a white berry that Colonel Stirling had thought up, and it was just like a woman's white berry. And believe it or not, about 21 chaps went on leave, and there were about 128 police charges against 21 in a few days. And the chaps were recalled to Cabrit, where everything was put down to the white berry. There were chaps being punched all over, with the Aussies taking the mickey and everyone else taking the mickey. And it was nothing but trouble. So they were withdrawn immediately, the white berry. And I remember a chap named Slipstream Hawkins that lost his in car and went in and bought a woman's white berry with a tassel on it. Slipstream was a bit of a... But they were withdrawn, and we were issued then with these... I never remember the name of the thing, the flat things that open and sit on, I don't know if it's called that now, but they sit on the side there, and you walk around like this, you know, with your head on the side, and everyone got brain off. And then up came the beige berry. The wings and the cap badges and the berries came from John Jones in Cairo. They were the makers of all that stuff, and of course the beige berry went down a treat, and that later of course was lost when they the beige berry was lost in Norway, at the time of Norway when we came home. I know we had red ones, we had the paro, because the parachute regiment was always a little bit jealous of SAS, and we came under the brigade, airborne brigade, you see, or airborne division, and they immediately took the thing off. We were issued with red. But the one man who never put a red berry on was the colonel, Paddy Main, refused, and he was the only man walking around in the regiment with a beige until he left the army. And then, of course, that came back, the beige came back. Back at Euston, about 1952, after the Malayan thing, well, not after my Malayan thing, came back to Duplo, and we got back the beige berry to everyone's joy.
Going back to Cabrit then, so everyone's done the parachute jump. And what happened after that?
Well, then it was all raring to go for the first operation. And we were told that the first operation was going to be at two airfields, one at Gazala and one at Tamimi, which were about 300 miles behind the lines.
Is this the... You did one practice one, didn't you?
Oh, no, we did more than one practice. We did... Right. No, we did...
Tell me about that, then.
Oh, no, we did about 5 daylight, 6 daylight, and one night jump before we did the first operation.
What was the one that you actually... Tell me about those sort of practice raids, then. What sort of practice operations, what did those consist of?
What, before we operated, you mean? Yeah. Oh, well, the big one, the big exercise before we were ready for ops was laid on to march from Kibrit to Cairo, straight across the desert, and to attack Heliopolis airfield. And when we got onto the airfield, we were issued with four pints of water, a piece of Hessian. I think we had about a pound of dates, half a pound of boiled sweets, the biscuits we used to call sand channels because you couldn't bite them, the old army biscuits, some raisins, and that was about a lot. And when you appreciate that you didn't march through the daytime, you laid on the desert, and you had this piece of Hessian sacking stuff, that if they had planes, our own planes out looking for us, you see, and you just put the Hessian right over yourself and camouflage yourself up if aircraft were evade. And of course you conserve water because you didn't march, but you couldn't have marched by day, and you marched by night. So, and believe me, to do 100 miles on 4 bottles of water in the desert is a hell of a feat. It's a thing I wouldn't want to try and start looking at now, when you consider the heat of that desert in the daytime, you know, you don't touch your water. And then the object was to get into Heliopolis and put labels on these planes, and David Stone had a bet with the command, whatever the rank was, the man in charge of Heliopolis RAF, he'd had a bet with him that he'd stick so many labels on the plane. So, of course, they had a terrific guard around the perimeter to, because he didn't fancy losing £100, I think, the bet was. But we did get in there and we put labels all over.
Was that difficult to get in? I mean, or how do you...
No, it's just a matter of watching sentries and just going in at the opportune moment. It's dead easy. The strange thing is that the thing that always amazed me was how easy it was to get into the airfields on the German airfield. Mm. It was so easy, you know. So you just walked in. They did start putting fences up and things at Benghazi and Benin around those places, but it never stopped anyone getting in there. And you could sort of, as I did with Paddy Maine, we watched the sentries walking up the road and we just held up until they got so far up the road. Then we crossed the road, went the other side where the planes were in against the trees, the big bombers, and just went down throwing the bombs up. And when we'd done the 15, we just looked at the signal centers about just crossed the road and mounted into the desert. And by the time we went up, you were a good 3 to 4 miles away, pretty near running, you know, safe to get out. And then you could watch them all go up. But it's the thing that thing I've found in life is the harder a thing seems, as far as SAS was concerned, the easier it was. There's a strange thing about it. So, and I mean, it'd be so easy now to go down to Green and Common. Would you want something to eat?
Yeah,
really. Yeah. It's so easy, to, it's the easiest thing in the world, Gordon, to go in anywhere. If you say, right, go into Greenham Common, go in, it's the easiest thing in the world to get in. Because sentries are human, and they're so easy to get past.
Going back then to the first raid proper, or the night.
I'll just nip into the toilet first, Gordon. I'll have a drink for you.
Okay, then.
Yeah. On the first operation, we flew up to a place called Bagoosh, and they laid a meal on the night before the operation. Terrific meal the RAF laid on, and it was like sitting on a meal of the Last Supper. You know, we were all saying, well, this is a bit dodgy, you know, in those days, we good God, 300 miles behind the lines, you know. And they gave us this great big meal, and we sort of look at each other and saying, well, this is it, this might be the Last Supper, you know. But going on from there...
How many people went on that raid?
I think about 52, I should somewhere between 50 and 54 dropped on that. And then, of course, what happened on that was that the weather went and storm started. The wind started blowing and they contacted Colonel David and said, look, this is terrible weather for dropping. You're going to have casualties. And apparently he said, well, look, whatever happens, we've got to go. Because these chaps we'd had so much in the commandos of nearly getting there and then not, you know, and coming back, that it was decided to drop. And I was with Paddy Mainstick, and we jumped out. We had the containers then. We didn't carry any kit bags like they do today. We had containers dropped separate from the personnel with, you know, with explosives, rations, everything else. Then. Sorry, no, my love.
You can see you cut the electric knife, Benny. I've cut that red stick.
Oh, that's, you can't lovely. Cut it too thin. No, no, it's not. Gordon doesn't want to sit down eating little tiny pansy
well,
sandwich,
very,
do you, Gordon?
Very sure.
Is that.
Of,
that's all.
That's all right. Object was that first exercise or the first operation?
Oh, was to attack the airfields. Is it on?
Yeah.
To attack the airfields at Gazala and Tamimi and to destroy planes. But as I say, you didn't carry a kit bag, your containers. Hold most of your equipment, your bombs, everything up. Well, we bailed out, and I hit the deck and was dragged for about a half a mile. Just couldn't get out of the chute. The wind was blowing that fast, the gale was blowing that fast. And just being dragged along with your arms up like that, and everyone was the same. And it took a heck of a time to... get people together because they were spread all over the place and it's pitch black. And when we did get everyone together...
How do you get people together in that situation?
I mean, well, this is a funny thing. I know we were dropped about 30 miles from the coast, you know, in the desert, but everything was supposed to be working in silence, you know, and it turned out so comical because everyone was shaking their heads, obviously, saying... Where are you? You know, and when we did get together, two of our chaps had suffered broken ankles, and that knocked up. We just had to leave them there on the deep. We had to leave them where they were. What happened to them, I never know, but we had to go on. And the trouble was that we only found about one container out of all the containers, so we were short of everything, you see. Short of water, very few Lewis bombs we had left. And these two poor chaps, I think Dougie Arnold, Arnold and Dougie Keith, we had to leave them what water we could. So whether they got picked up, I don't know from this day, from that day to this. I doubt if they did. I should imagine they would have perished, unless the Jerrys had sent a recce out next day, you know. And then the heavens opened up, and we were sitting on the edge of a wadi, and the torrential rain came down, and without any, not a word of a lot, the wadi filled up with water. It's the worst storms they'd had for years and years. And we were sitting there, six of us, with blankets over our heads, you know. And of course we couldn't operate, so the thing was that we had to get back to the rendezvous, which had been arranged. I suppose the water did save our life in that case, because we filled our bottles, you know, and we had good drinks, filled our bottles that we had from the wadis, and in a way that must have saved our lives a bit. And then we started marching back to the DZ that was arranged with the Long Range Desert Group, Jock Easton Smith was the major in charge of it, and we got back to the rendezvous, and there were only 22 people got back out of the lot that dropped. One of the planes was shot down. Pity the chap's just died who piloted that. He died about a year ago, Charlie West. And quite a few were killed, and quite a number captured. One of the people that, or rather, one, two of the people that were captured on that first operation, a chap named Ernie Bond, who was a commissioner of police. Mm. You know him, do you?
No, that Bond.
Ernie Bond, yeah. Nice chap, yeah.
Yeah,
he was captured on the first op. Now, I've got his address if you'd like to get in touch with Ernie. You can get his story of what happened, you know. He was the man that did the Spaghetti House raid. He was the man who put the SAS into the police force, Ernie. He did Spaghetti House, and what was the other one he did?
Balcombe Street, was it? He was on all those.
Ernie, he put the SAS into the police. Lives down in Welling, just outside London. But Ernie was one that was with Charlie West, who was a sergeant pilot, that was forced down. Anyhow, as I say, we got back to the rendezvous, and we were all taken back from there, back to an oasis, about 500 miles south of Benghazi, Siwa. We were taken back there, and then the predicament was that we sort of couldn't all go back, we couldn't go back to base, because after all this business that David Stirling was going to do this and do that, you can't go back with a flop. So it was arranged from
there. Who was at that Oasis End?
No one, just a Long Range Desert Group.
And yourselves?
And ourselves.
So that would have been Stirling, David,
that's it.
Paddy Mayne, the whole...
Yeah, the whole, the 22 that got back. And from there, he started planning, you get that from David, he started planning operations, and quite a few operations were planned with just three or four people going out, which you'll get from the Phantom Major. You'll get all those details from there. And Bill Fraser went off with a party with Bob Tate and a chap named Phillips, and they got more, the biggest amount of planes it was ever got. They got 37 aircraft on their airfield. Paddy went off to Tamit, and they got 24 aircraft, and I'd left Paddy to go over to Jock Lewis. We'd swapped the sections around a bit, you see, from the 22. I went off with Jock Lewis, and we went to a place called Aguilia, which turned out there were no aircraft there, and we finished up blowing up a few communications, and then the next night, taking a big Lancia truck that we captured, a big 10-ton Lancia truck with a 20mm breeder on the back, taking that onto the main road, and the long-range desert group trucks with us on the back going down the road, and Jock Lewis said, "Now light your cigarettes up," and now this is right behind the lines, and we all lit fags up and went, and the Germans were coming up the road and take no notice, and he found out that there was this halfway house place that the Germans used, so we were going to do that up, and we actually did, you know, shoot the place up and put bombs on trucks, and we captured an Italian prisoner that they wanted one back, you know. We took this Italian prisoner back with us, who thought that we were Germans, and as we were amongst the trucks, he came up to Jock with a flag, and he said, "Lucia, you know." So Jock gave him a light and stuck a pistol in his side and said, "Get on the truck." And this guy said, "Italiano." And old Jock said, "Inglese, get
up there." It must have come as hell of a shock to that man.
Yeah, and we brought him back, and we'd also captured a couple of Libyans that were, well, they were useless. Absolutely useless. We captured these two Libyans with outdated weapons, and one's name was Ali, and we'd left them with the other party. We'd split into parties, you know, and we left them. Anyway, we took them all back to Cabrit, and I always remember when we got back to our lines onto the road, we handed the prisoner over to the MPs, and the MP started getting very naughty, you know, with this prisoner. And old Dave Kershaw jumped off and said, with a nice lot of bad language, you know, "Get up the front if you want to start doing that sort of thing," he said, you know, "don't bolt them right here," which was typical in any war, you know, the ones at the back did all the... and Ali, they put in the canteen at Cabrit, and he drunk himself silly. He went alcoholic. This Libyan... He finished up completely
human side, but David
completely alcoholic. Ali turned.
I mean,
he loved it. He was in the canteen working away, and the boys liked him, you know. "Hello, Ali," you know. And God, I should imagine he passed out, because his last time I was when he was in a terrible state. Ali.
He was passed on to somebody else, was he then?
The Otto was passed on for information, actually, yes. But the Libyan didn't have any. They didn't know what day it was.
Not all that matched.
I mean, going back a stage, after you'd actually pulled out and got to the rendezvous point and got back to the Oasis with the Long Range Desert Group,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that was obviously fairly crucial, wasn't it, that you actually went out and did something again? Otherwise, well, you'd actually gone back to the lines.
You couldn't go back, you see. Right. They'd have said, "That's it, finished," you see. But once you've done those operations, then help started coming. I mean, he had no help at all. Although he'd been promised by the powers to be that he would get help, everyone was anti. You know, the the majors in the headquarters and the colonels, they were all against SAS, you know. But after that, we did start getting somewhere as far as...
I mean, you actually got back to this Oasis, and then how long did you spend there before you went out and did...
I can't quite remember. Not long. Mm. No, very, very short time.
But David had been planning it.
He'd been planning, yeah.
We sat down and planned it.
That's it, yeah. It wasn't a long period, you know. Then, of course, then we all went back to Cairo and got issued with the wings and, you know, the warning with the wings and the white berets. Then we were on our way, you see.
But when you talk about a stick, what does that mean? I often wonder this. Is that just the formation for jumping from the plane? Or?
Oh, that's, yeah, yeah.
If I ever ask any silly questions...
Oh, I mean, there's so many of you.
Yes, yeah, but we never use that a lot, you know.